clapped her hands over her mouth, but when she tried to shift again, a low animal sound escaped from under her hand. She looked at me in apology. I looked away, but she waved me forward and then tapped at my clenched fist. Though dreading the message, I gave her access. "Baby coming," she wrote. I pulled back my hand and rubbed the palm with my thumb as though to erase the message. This was impossible. We couldn't journey out with a newborn. We both knew it. Without warning, her body stiffened. "Dear God," I thought, "she is having the child." I rubbed my face with my hands. What to do? I must leave before they hear her and find us. Yes. Yes, I would take Pan and leave. As though she read my thoughts, Suki grabbed at my hand and her torn fingernails scratched into my palm. "Take baby." I stared at her as she wrote it again. "Take baby." What did she mean? Take Pan? But no, she had said baby. Did she actually expect me, a man who knew nothing about childbirth, to somehow deliver a child and then flee with it? The idea was insane. I wouldn't sacrifice my life like this. I scuttled to the opening and glanced back at her beseeching eyes. When Suki stiffened again and gave a muffled cry, I leaped from the cave.
Chapter 40. 1830. Suki. The child's been coming since early today, and sure enough, just like I was afraid, Jamie goes running off without me. From the start, I see he don't want nothing to do with me, 'cause I see him as colored and he knows, being with me, he's pegged for a Negro. When Jamie goes, it's easy to decide. Without him, I got no hope. Before the animals get us, I'm gonna let the baby die. I won't look at it. I won't help it breathe. The reason for me to run was to get this one free. But I can't make it out of this place by myself. My stomach turns hard again and the pains burn. Push, push. I try hard not to make a sound. Don't want no animal showing up. I feel around me for the stick. I put it in my mouth and bite down. I'll get this child out, and then we both can die in peace. I've seen worse ways to die. All of a sudden, the boy shows up. "I'm here, Suki. I can help." He grabs hold of my hand and gives me his palm. "Tell me what to do," Pan says. "Get out of here," I write, then slap at him to get him moving. I hear him crying when he goes out, but now I can get my business done. I bite down. Push, push. Don't make no noise. Pain, push, pain, push. I feel it come. It plops out. Little arms, feet pushing out. I feel it moving. My head throws itself back and forth. I'm fighting with myself, not letting my hands reach for it. But then it cries. I grab down, bring it up, and push it against me to stop it from breathing. The little mouth is working for air. I push in harder. I grunt and bite down hard on the stick. But this time, the stick snaps. And that's when the mama in me takes over. She spits out the wood pieces, grabs at the bloody cord, bites through it, frees the child, then gives it my breast. When the child latches on, I look down and see it's a girl. And all that's left of me howls for mercy. "Don't cry, Suki. Don't cry." The boy is back. "I'm gonna help you out," he says. And I reach to kiss his sweet hand.
Chapter 41. 1830. James. Panic lit a fire in me. When I passed Pan, I grasped his arm and shouted for him to run. When he fought me, I struggled to keep hold of him. "We've got to go," I called out, holding tight. "We've got to get out of here."
"What about Suki?" he cried, pulling away. "She's by herself, having a baby."
"We can't stay," I looked around wildly, sure I heard our pursuers. "Come, we've got to go." It did not occur to me that the heavy panting I heard was my own breath. Believing that we were to be killed, I began to shout in terror. "Come! Come!" I pulled roughly at his arm, but he freed himself and backed away.
"Mr. Burton," Pan called out, "you're not thinking right."
I left him then and ran. Pan's call long faded and still I ran, the sound of my own rasping breath fueling me. My terror had broken free and escape was all I knew. Perspiration dripped into my good eye and near blind I was in the water, stumbling over cypress roots, then back on dry land, tearing through thickets of juniper and green briar. It was the appearance of the bear that brought me back to my senses. The black bear that had been wounded earlier in the day emerged from the green and roared his protest as I struggled onto his small dry island. On first sight, I addressed him as though he were human. But as my reason returned, I stopped my muttering and slowly backed into the water. Something long slithered around my leg and I stood frozen, waiting for the snake to kill me first. The bear moved forward, his hackles up. Slowly, he swayed toward me. Foam frothed and flew from his clacking teeth, and when he charged, trapped in a tangle of cypress roots, I waited for death. Then, unbelievably, not 20 feet from me, he splashed down. My legs gave way and I slid into the brown water as death tremors shook the bear's body. When my strength returned, I crawled back up onto the island to sit, stunned. I was alive. Somehow I had survived. I looked about, disbelieving. What had I done? I had abandoned Pan, but worse, I had left Suki while she was birthing a child. What kind of man was I? When I thought of them alone and of the animals that might approach the cave, I got to my feet. I must go back. Still dazed, I set off, but night was falling and I soon found myself lost. My only hope was to wait until morning, so I found a dry spot where I waited out the night. I awoke with the morning's light. My head felt clear, and after I had drunk my fill of the tannic water, I set out once again. I remained lost, circling for hours until I remembered a technique that Henry had taught me to find my way back to his shelter. I set up triangles of long sticks on the edges of dry land, and by late morning I had found my way back to the small island. Pan sat alone outside the cave under a pine, and a more forlorn-looking child I had never seen. When he noticed me, his eyes lit up, first in relief, and then in fury. "Did she have the baby?" I asked. He looked away, refusing to give an answer. I went to the cave and held my breath as I pulled back the entrance covering. "Suki," I whispered, and a small mewling noise answered me. Suki raised her head, then with a sigh let it fall back again. An overpowering stench filled the cave, but I was drawn in, first by remorse, and then by astonishment when I saw something suckling at Suki's breast. "Forgive me," I began, but Suki's hot hand grasped my palm. "Water," she scratched. And when she scratched it again, I realized the urgency. I couldn't think of what to use for a receptacle until I remembered my leather slippers. Though wet and worn, they were largely intact. Pan looked up as I exited the cave. "She needs water," I said.
"I've been trying, but it don't stay in my fingers. All night I was looking for something to put the water in."
He leaned his head on his knees and began to cry. "I'm going to try to use my shoe," I said. He didn't follow me down to the water, but watched from his sitting position as I rinsed out my slipper as well as I could, and then hurried back while cradling water in the awkward container. When I lifted her head, Suki's skin felt hot and dry. Though a good deal of water spilled down her neck, she drank thirstily and I went back for more. When she was sated, I attempted to take the baby from her, but she shook her head and clung to it tightly. I left her then, needing to escape the oppressive odor. Pan was still seated under the pine, but when I sat next to him, he turned his back to me.
Pan? I don't like you no more, he said. When I get out of this mess, I'm going to live with my daddy. He don't have much and he's going to whoop me for going to the docks, but he don't never leave me like that the way you done.
I'm sorry, Pan, I said. I don't know what happened. I guess fear just got the better of me. I shook my head in disbelief, remembering the overriding panic.
You don't know what happened? What happened is you run away, leaving Suki and me here to die.
But I came back, I said.
Why?
He asked. Because I care about you.
Phew, I got a daddy who care about me. All I gotta do is get back to find him.
The truth came out. Pan, I said. Your daddy came with me to find you. He turned enough to give me a skeptical look.
He come with you? Then where is he?
He got sick up in Norfolk. I called in a doctor twice, but he couldn't help. He swung toward me in a fury.
You saying he's laying sick someplace? You run off and leave him too?
No, I said, realizing that I should have waited to tell him.
Then where is he? He demanded.
I'm afraid that he died. Pan got to his feet and took a few steps away before he turned back. His dark eyes narrowed.
Why you saying that? He asked.
I'm sorry, Pan, I said. Maybe I shouldn't have told you this now.
You saying my daddy come down here to slave country and he'd die? You tell me the truth?
Yes, Pan, I said. I'm afraid I am. His chin trembled as he fought for control.
You sure the slave catcher don't get him?
No, Pan. He had a cough and then he got very ill. I was with him when he passed away.
You was with him?
I was, and I was there when he was buried. When we get out of here, I can take you to see his grave.
I don't want to see no grave, he said.
Slowly he walked to the water's edge, where he slumped to his knees. There he leaned into himself and began a desperate call for his father. I followed. Pan, I'm sorry.
Go away,
he shouted and struck out at me, and I knew then to let him be. At a loss, I decided to see to Suki and force myself into the sickening smell of the cave to face the task of cleaning her up. Her torn petticoat lay beside her, and she closed her glazed eyes after I tore loose a large piece and told her of my intentions. I had not expected to see such a fresh amount of blood, and while my stomach heaved, I cleaned her as thoroughly as I was able. Off to the side, I found the umbilical cord attached to a small piece of what I guessed to be afterbirth. Though uncertain, I suspected there ought to be more. I don't know how many trips I made out to the water to rinse the rag, but only later, as I gathered moss to pack between Suki's legs in an attempt to staunch the blood flow, did I see Pan take notice. During my ministrations, the baby gave an occasional soft mewl, but I didn't touch it. It was impossibly tiny, and I was sure it could not survive for long. Finally satisfied that I had done all I could, I returned outdoors and went to sit beside Pan, who remained at the water's edge. If she is to get well, I'll need your help, Pan, I said. Pan sounded drained when he spoke.
That little one is so small, it can't even cry. Those the kind that die. I saw it when I was helping Suki in her sick house.
I agree that it looks weak, but we must do our best for Suki. Can I count on you to help me out?
Wasn't me who'd go running off, he said bluntly.
I won't do that again, Pan, I said.
We'll see, he mumbled.
Pan, I'm sorry, I said. I'm sorry about your father, but always remember that he was a good man. He kept his eyes away from me.
He was so good, then why did he always go running off and leave me and my mama?
He was scared, Pan. He was scared of getting caught.
I don't hold with him leaving my mama to die like that, he said.
I know it doesn't seem right, but I guess his fear of getting caught was bigger than anything else. I suppose I did the same thing last night. My fear just took over. He sniffed loudly before he turned to me.
And what was you so afraid of? He asked.
I picked up a nearby twig and used it to poke at the mossy ground. Pan, the truth is, I've been scared and running for most of my life.
What was you running from?
His voice was hard. I took a deep breath. To start with, when I was a young boy, I thought I was white. When I was just around your age, I found out that my mother was a Negro. Since then, I've been trying to pass as a white man. It's a secret that I've been hiding all of my life.
You saying your mama was colored like me? He asked.
His curiosity sparked in spite of himself. That is what I'm saying, I said, digging deep into the moss while he stared at me. And we can't return to Philadelphia because of it, I added. Pan's thin shoulders sagged.
It don't matter, Mr. Burton. We all gonna die out here anyway.
His hopelessness startled me. I forced a confidence that I did not feel. Pan, we're not gonna die. We will come through this, and someday you will be the man your father always knew you would be. We'll get through this, I promise.
We'll see,
he said, unconvinced, then clutched at his stomach as it growled audibly. This morning I ate some huckleberries, I said, pointing to the abundant blue fruit. They went right through me, so we can't eat many.
I ate them too, he admitted, but they make my stomach hurt.
If we're going to be here until Suki recovers, we're going to have to eat something more substantial, I said. But I don't dare try to get a fire going.
When my daddy got nothing else to eat, he eat grubs. Say they give you some get up and go.
Let's go find some, I said, and though the idea was less than appealing, I knew their nutritional value. The earth on this island teemed with oversized black beetles, and where there were bugs, there were grubs. We didn't have to look far for decaying logs, and when I turned the first one over, there squirmed a large white larvae. Pan watched as I picked one up.
You gonna try it?
He said, grimacing as I held it up. I did not allow myself to think before I tossed one in my mouth and began to chew. Biting down into the soft body, I began to retch but quickly ate some huckleberries and forced myself to swallow. Ah, I said, not bad.
Then why you look like you about to bring it back up? He asked.
I'm just getting used to the fine flavor, I teased, and was rewarded with a flicker of a smile. Come on. I handed him one, taking another for myself. If your daddy ate these to survive, so can we. The next one went down more easily. But the taste was bitter and the texture appalling. I forced down a few more of the large globs. Pan ate too. When we knelt to drink water, a sizable grasshopper landed between us, and Pan snatched it up.
We ate hoppers, too, but the legs got spikes and got to come off first.
He plucked off first the head and then the legs.
Here, he said.
I was unsure if the offer was a token or a challenge, but I knew it was edible and accepted it. It crunched as I chewed, and I swallowed plenty of water to get it down. Not bad, I said. Now let's find one for you.
Maybe later, Pan said, and again gave me a ghost of a smile.
Our stomachs rumbled, but we retained the food, so we gathered some grubs and huckleberries for Suki. She chewed and swallowed some berries, but refused a second grub. As though the effort had taken all of her energy, she closed her eyes and let the babe slip down beside her, where it lay mewling. Finally, I took it from the cave. Pan followed me to the water's edge and watched over my shoulder as I laid the bundle down to unravel the soiled petticoat. A ray of sun broke through the green canopy to cast golden light on an infant so minuscule that I might have held her in my one hand. Her wrinkled body squirmed as she squinted against the sun, while the sparse downy hair on her head stood out like that of a newly hatched bird. Unexpectedly, my heart twisted with tenderness. Her umbilical cord had been tied off with a strip of fabric. Again, I marveled at Suki's determination to save her child's life. The cloth around the baby's bottom was crusted to her.
You gotta get her washed off, Pan said, testing the water with his hand. But you gotta do it quick.
Get ready, I said, lifting her up and dipping her in to soak while Pan rubbed her clean. Her little breaths came in surprised puffs while her extremities reached out in an odd quivering stretch.
Best get her out now, Pan said.
On impulse, I slipped her shivering body inside my torn shirt to warm her against my own skin. Pan fetched another piece of clean petticoat, then lined it with soft moss, fashioning a clout before we swaddled her into a bigger piece of cloth. Through it all, the tiny bit of life made soft mewling sounds. Suki slept on. We kept the babe with us and sat under the pine to study the now fresh-smelling bundle. As she looked out, I was astounded to see curiosity in her large dark eyes. When she mewled, Pan reached over to pat down her hair.
You sound like a kitty, he said. Let's call her Kitty.
Don't get too attached, I warned. I doubt she will live. She gave a huge yawn, and when I gently tapped her tiny chin, her fingers quivered up and grasped mine. In spite of my own warning, I felt my heart give over. The air during the day was hot and often humid, but it did not rain, and the days passed swiftly as I sought to care for the four of us. I gave to Pan and the baby what was left of the bear grease and fought to keep from scratching at the oozing raised red rash that covered my legs and arms. While my unshorn facial hair served as a barrier against the biting flies and hordes of mosquitoes, my torn and tattered clothing did not. As Suki weakened, the baby increasingly became my focus. Each day she survived felt like a victory. In spite of my best efforts, by the third day Suki was no longer lucid. Pan had found an old turtle shell, and though she drank water from it readily, she always turned her face away from the grubs. The morning I found three duck eggs, I rushed in with one for Suki, but was disheartened when she turned her head in refusal. I later cracked open all three, and Pan and I gratefully swallowed the rich nutrients, a welcome change from the usual grubs, grasshoppers, and huckleberries. By the fifth day, Suki refused even the berries. Thinking it was the effort to chew that stopped her, I chewed the food myself before pushing it into her mouth. That almost ended in disaster, for the paste dropped back in her throat and choked her. Though I was able to have her cough it up, the episode left her drained. When I cleaned her that evening, fresh blood, a great deal more than usual, soaked through the packed moss. The following morning, Suki was no longer responding, though she still swallowed water when I put it in her mouth. Kitty suckled vigorously when I held her to Suki's breast. I wondered if she was getting enough nourishment, and as her mother's life ebbed away, I argued with myself about what to do. Should we just leave and try to save Kitty? How many hours could a baby survive without milk? Yet I could not abandon Suki while she was still alive. At night there were too many carnivores about. Finally, on the sixth day, Suki provided the solution. Around noon, while Pan gathered grubs, I took Kitty for another feeding and there discovered that Suki had died. I'd sensed her death coming, but the reality of it shook me. Clutching Kitty, I scrambled for the cave and called for Pan. He came at a run. "She's dead," I said abruptly. "We have to leave." He hung his head for a moment, then lifted it again.
"We got to bury her," he said.
"We can't. We have no tools. And you know she would want us to take care of Kitty first. We need to find some milk for her as soon as possible."
"How are we going to do that?" he asked.
I handed Kit to him as I reached for the primitive basket that I had fashioned from the plentiful reeds in preparation for our departure. "I don't know, but we don't have a lot of time," I said. I lined the basket with plenty of moss and then added what was left of Suki's petticoat. Settling Kitty in the basket and tucking my jacket into the waist of my tattered trousers, I announced that I was ready to leave. Pan looked lost and walked back to the entrance of the cave.
"At least you gotta say something," he said.
"You're right," I said, joining him. I tried to think of some words, but when I lowered my head, nothing came. The baby squirmed, and while I readjusted her, Pan grew impatient.
"You can say something nice about Suki. And then I suppose you can ask my mama for some help, but she don't seem to be around since I got took."
"How about your daddy?" I asked, feeling more comfortable invoking Henry. Pan shrugged. "Suki was a good woman," I began.
"But now we need some help," Pan interrupted. "Daddy, if you see us out here, you gotta get us some help."
His voice choked at the mention of his father, and my own eyes blurred. I looked up and took in the beauty of the long green swags and red flowering vines that draped across the cathedral-sized trees. Under this protective canopy, an unexpected peace washed over me and gave me newfound strength. Through Pan's sobs, I spoke out in a strong voice. "Henry and Suki," I said, "you were both brave and good, and because of it, we know you were with the Lord. Please ask him to help us out." I was rewarded for my effort when Pan rubbed his face dry and looked up at me.
"You did that good, Mr. Burton," he said. "Now we best get going."
I decided we would go north to the Cross Canal. But there, instead of going east to the large canal as instructed, we would turn west, where I had been told civilization was close by. I didn't know what story I would tell, but our only hope to save Kit lay in that direction. As we traveled, I felt that we were being watched. The night before, wolves had sounded particularly close, and I was worried that they were stalking us now. I didn't allow myself to think of what might happen to Sugi's body back in the cave. As before, we fought the endless vegetation, and while Pan kept up the pace, he traveled silently. Alone, I might have despaired, but saving both Kit and Pan gave me purpose, so I plunged ahead, using the moss-covered trees and bits of sunlight for direction. A few hours into our trek, we came to a dry spot where I decided to check on a silent kitty. I held my breath when I lifted her still body from the basket. "Kit. Kit?" I called, tapping her satin face until she gave a weak cry. Pan grabbed hold of my arm so abruptly that I almost dropped Kit.
"Mr. Burton," he whispered as a short Negro man stepped out from the trees. "He got a knife."
Pan pointed to the long curved weapon the man carried.
"Don't mean no harm," the aged man said, quickly sheathing his weapon and attaching it to the cord that held up what was left of his pants. "I's Willie," he said. "Been watching you. What you doing with that baby?"
"She needs milk," I said.
"Come, we get some,"
he said and motioned us forward. "Let's go," I said to Pan. The old man turned southeast and moved so quickly that had we not been so determined to keep up, we might have lost him. Within a half hour, we arrived at a large island. There, back in the woods, sat three small huts, similar to those of the quarters on a plantation, but these were built up on stilts. Under the shacks, chickens pecked in the dirt, and a staked goat bleated out a greeting to Willie. An old woman seated in the doorway of the largest hut gave me a startled look.
"Peg, come."
Willie waved her over. The old woman hesitated until she saw Pan. Then she set aside the basket she was weaving and came forward.
"Please, she needs milk," I said, holding Kitty out.
My heart sank when the baby's little arms flopped down.
"Do you have some milk?" Pan pleaded.
The woman leaned forward for a better look, then abruptly went for a bucket that hung from the side of the hut. In a few minutes, Kitty was slurping warm goat's milk through a small piece of swamp reed.
"Can't she have more?" I asked when the feeding stopped. "First we gotta see if she can hold it down," Willie said to me. "I can't know what he's talking about," Peg mumbled to herself. "Give me that child."
She snatched Kitty from my arms.
"Give the boy something to eat," she directed Willie,
her deep, gravelly voice all the more surprising because of her tiny frame.
"Can Mr. Burton have something to eat, too?"
Pan asked, and the woman gave me a dark look before she walked away. I was concerned for Kitty, but Willie waved me forward.
"She take care of that baby. She just don't like to see no white man here. Come."
He led us over to a fire pit. From a large black pot, he ladled out simmering stew into bowl-sized turtle shells, then handed us each a rough wooden spoon. Pan looked as though he might weep at the sight of the nourishing stew, and we both ate with relish while Willie disappeared into the hut. When Pan went into the woods to relieve himself, I sat back against a tree and closed my eyes in momentary contentment. Suddenly, I was thrown to the ground. Though it was futile, I fought a ferocious-looking Negro, one who was twice my size. When he flipped me around to face him, his long, tangled hair fell forward into his unshaven face, but didn't conceal the hatred in his dark eyes. Willie and Peg, with Kitty in her arms, rushed from the house.
"Pete," Willie called, "let him go." "What this white man doing here, Willie?"
the large man shouted.
"He lost, but he got two little niggas with him," Willie said. "Oh, he gonna be lost all right," Pete replied with a harsh laugh.
I groaned when his knee dug into my stomach. A knife pricked my neck and I closed my eyes. "Let it happen fast," I prayed.
"Let him go!"
Pan flew out from the trees to strike at the large man's back. Pete caught Pan with his elbow and sent the boy flying while he twisted what was left of my shirt and pulled me to my feet.
"What you doing out here?" he asked, pinning me against a tree.
I spat dirt from my mouth.
"I'm trying to get up north. We came from a place south of here. There are patrollers after us." "South of here? You talking about Southwood?"
Pete asked, and I nodded.
"You hear that, Willie? He say he coming up from Southwood."
I had long since lost my eye patch, and Pete studied my useless, clouded eye.
So you that one-eyed man they say in is black. There are men all over the canal looking for you. They give big money for you. Where's the gal you was running with? Name Asuki.
She died, I said. Pan pointed to Kitty in Peg's arms.
That's her baby.
And who's you? Pete asked.
I got took for a slave, Pan said. And Mr. Burton is taking me home.
Pete turned back to me.
You say Suki, the one who run that sick house, she'd die, and that's her baby?
Yes, I said, unexpectedly hopeful. There's a man who lives somewhere close to this swamp who went by the name of Doc McDougal.
Old Doc. Yeah, we know him, don't we, Willie?
Willie nodded.
He has a friend, Mr. Spencer, I added. If you can get word to Mr. Spencer of our whereabouts, I'm sure he could help us out.
How you think anybody gonna get you out of here? They hunting you like a dog, Pete said.
Look, I said, pleading now. I came down here to find the boy. He was stolen from Philadelphia.
Pete grunted, then he and Willie exchanged a furtive glance.
Please, I begged. I need your help.
We'll see, was Pete's answer.
Chapter 42 1830 James. During that first week, as Kitty adjusted to the goat's milk, Pan and I grew stronger from the hearty stews cooked by Peg. The woman liked no one and especially disliked me, but Pan trailed her as a boy might a mother. Soon she was favoring him and even taught him to milk her beloved pet goat, the only living creature she seemed to care about. Willie usually left early in the morning to hunt or forage for food. Though Pete left each day as well, he was more secretive about his doings. One evening, after we had all eaten our fill of a roasted wild pig, Peg divided the remainder of the meat into two wooden buckets before Pete and Willie carried them out into the night.
"There's others needin' food," was Peg's explanation to Pan, and later that night Pan told me more.
"She say there's others who live out here. They was all slaves, just like Peg and Willie, and they all been here for a long time. She say this is their home now."
Toward the end of the week, Pete came back with news that there were patrollers along the canal route searching for us.
"Everybody want that money," he said, and worried that he and Willie were not immune to the same temptation, I began to press for a departure date.
"We gotta wait,"
he said, then indicated with a nod for me to continue chopping wood. I was so anxious to leave that, foolhardy as it would have been, I might have taken Pan and Kitty and struck out on my own. However, through Willie, I learned that this island had been chosen for their home because it was protected, surrounded by alligator and snake-infested waters. As dangerous were the numerous still ponds around the island, covered by a greasy surface sheen that camouflaged thick, sucking mud.
"Man don't know where he going. He step in that, don't ever see him again," Willie said.
One evening toward the end of the second week, as Willie, Pan, and I sat at the fireside and watched while Peg tested the readiness of a roasting possum, Pete burst through the trees.
"We set for tonight. 'Fore sun up, we gotta get you out to the cross ditch. Barge coming up, gonna take you to a wagon to get you to Norfolk."
My chest began to thump. Weren't the patrollers still out there? I'd been waiting for this, but now I was afraid to leave. Daily, I had reviewed each fear and obstacle we might face. The most concerning had to do with Kitty.
"What about Kitty?" I asked. "What will we do for milk?"
The question hung in the air as I looked from one to the other.
"Best you ask Peg if she give you her goat," Willie finally said.
Peg shot him a sharp look.
"But..."
Pan protested, knowing what the animal meant to Peg. I looked to the old woman, certain of her denial. She clutched her hands together as she gazed at her prized goat, then turned back to Willie and gave a quick nod. I was disbelieving, yet I looked to Pete.
"How can we take a goat?"
"You think that the biggest thing we ever carry out?"
Pete asked, then went silent as though he had said too much. Peg went over to the fire and removed the possum from the spit, then pulled the sweet potatoes from the coals. No one needed further encouragement to eat, but as we did, Peg went off to her hut. I leaned over to Willie and asked if she was coming back out to join us. He shook his head.
"Let her be. She's getting used to the idea of losing her goat, and the boy.
he added, nodding to Pan. It had grown late, but as we prepared to leave, Peg returned to insist that we give Kitty a last feeding. Pan, as excited as I had ever seen him, went to Peg as she fed Kitty.
Do you want me to write to you and tell you how we got through?
You know I can't do no reading, she said.
I can draw some pictures, how about that?
You good at it? She asked.
Not as good as Mr. Burton, he said.
I want him from you, she said.
Pan looked around as though we'd suddenly remembered our whereabouts.
Where should I send them?
Send them to that Mr. Spencer. He'll get them to me, she said, solidifying a connection I'd guessed at.
Pan watched as she changed the baby's clout and then settled Kitty into a new moss-lined basket.
You gonna miss Kitty, Miss Peg? Pan asked.
She too much work,
Peg said, handing Pan a small leather bag that held clout-sized pieces of cloth, a small turtle shell, and fresh reeds for Kit's feedings.
Thank you, Miss Peg, Pan said,
and Peg's eyes glistened before she turned back toward her hut. I followed. Miss Peg, I called, addressing her with the formality that Pan always used.
What you want now?
She asked, turning back to face me. I want to thank you. I can never replace your goat, nor can I ever repay your kindness, but please take this. I reached for her hand and pressed my grandmother's large garnet and diamond brooch into her palm. Get that to Mr. Spencer, and he will get more goats for you if you like, I said. She closed her hand around the jewel, then turned and walked away. When I picked up Kitty's basket, Willie stole a last peek.
You raise her up good, he said. You tell her about us out here. How Peg do for her?
Pete moved swiftly, leading the muzzled goat through the impossibly thick vegetation. Each time something large slithered into the watery underbrush, the goat panicked and pulled back, until Pete, frustrated with her resistance, picked her up and slung her around his thick neck. Even with Pete burdened, Pan and I had to work hard to keep up as he navigated first the boggy land and then the gnarled and slippery tree roots. Though now familiar with the night sounds, I was often startled by disturbed wildlife as it flew up or rustled past us in the undergrowth. Kitty seldom fussed and Pan remained close by my side, but it was such a difficult hike that I had little time to worry about what lay ahead. My most immediate fear was that I would lose my balance and take Kit into the water. So I gripped tight the walking cane Willie had thrust into my hand on our departure. We trekked deep into the night, and even Pete appeared winded by the time we caught sight of the towpath. The night view of the winding canal was deceptively peaceful. Overhead trees leaned into one another, their branches folded together across the water as though in prayer. Down a distance, a long stretch of the canal was open to the sky, where the black shadow of a nighthawk glided across the still water. A lone owl hooted and wolves howled as though in answer. I grew increasingly anxious as I watched Pete pace the bank. Suddenly, he rushed back to where we waited in the underbrush.
Something coming, he whispered,
and through the shadows, as though moving through molasses, a small barge pulled into view. As it moved closer, I could make out a Negro man and a smaller boy moving toward us on the towpath. Each had hold of a long pole secured to the craft, and with these, they pushed the boat forward.
Come on, come on!
Pete waved us forward as the barge hit the bank.
Quick, climb up, he urged as he reached for Kitty.
I hesitated. What if once I was on the barge, he meant to keep her?
Just do what I say, he said, grabbing for Kitty's basket.
No, I argued until the woman on the barge reached down.
Give me the child, she whispered.
I handed Kitty up, and in short order, Pan and I found ourselves on board and standing next to piles of cut wood, melons, and sacks of grain.
Come quick, get in here,
the bargeman said, standing at the back and tossing away a stack of wood to expose a small trap door. He opened it and pointed.
Quick, get in, he said.
Pan leaned on his haunches for a look inside.
Both of us is supposed to fit in there?
Pan asked in a whisper, and the man nodded. The small barge, not more than a large raft, was built so low and loaded so heavily that it was impossible to believe any space could exist underfoot. Yet there it was. I hesitated, dreading the idea of that small space. I turned and saw Kitty in the woman's arms, then saw Pete sling up the objecting goat.
Go on,
the woman waved at me.
Go on, get in. I got the child.
To my later regret, I did not thank Pete, thinking only how I didn't want to wedge myself into that narrow, dark enclosure. But there was little time as the bargeman urged me in. I forced myself to my knees and slid in, then encouraged Pan to wedge himself in beside me. We lay flat on our stomachs in the narrow, damp space.
You gotta stay quiet, the bargeman warned as he closed the door behind us.
Wood clunked as it was tossed to cover over our hideout. Within minutes, the raft bumped away from the canal banks, and we slid off silently, but for the sound of the canal water rippling under us.
Chapter 43 1830 Pan. When we go from Willie's and Miss Peg's house, I'm not scared no more because I know my mama's watching out again. Miss Peg give us her goat because she's a good woman, but she don't like Mr. Burton for being a white man, even after I tell her that his mama was colored. You sure she colored? Miss Peg asked. I'm not sure of nothing no more, I say. Why not? Cause after my mama died, she say she was gonna look out for me. Then I got took for a slave. Where was she then? How you get took? Miss Peg asked. I snuck down to the docks where I wasn't supposed to go. Huh. How you expect your mama to look out for you when you act the fool? She asked. I never look at it that way before, so that night, when Mr. Burton's sleeping, I talk with my mama. You take care of Kitty and me and Mr. Burton, and I don't ever act a fool again. Then I go to sleep, 'cause now I know she's looking out for me. Mr. Burton and me is squished tight in the bottom of this boat. I see Mr. Burton scared and that he don't like this no better than me, but I'm glad I'm not on my own like I was under that wagon seat. I'm just hoping Mr. Burton keeps hisself settled. I never seen nothing like it when Kitty was coming and he took off running. I always thought Mr. Burton was something like God, that big a man. But then he goes off, leaving Suki and me. I'd have expected something like that from my daddy, but I was wrong about that, too. Turns out, afraid as my daddy was for getting took again, he come down into slave country looking for me. I never guess he'd have done that. He must have cared for me that much. Makes my throat hurt to think about it. My daddy was right. There's nothing worse than being a slave. I can't stop wondering what's going to happen to other boys like me now that Suki is gone. Who's going to help them get out of there? Feels like this boat is moving through the water at a fast clip. All I can think is that I don't know how to swim if it gets a leak. I can't talk to Mr. Burton because we was told to stay quiet, so I close my eyes and try to think of something else. I don't want to remember Southwood and what it's like to be a slave there, so I think about Miss Peg and how I told her that I would draw her some pictures. She told me that she and Willie help out other runners all the time, but always Negroes. She don't take to Mr. Burton. He act too white for me, she said. But I say to her, if I was white like him, I'd be acting white too. Why? She said. For one thing, they don't take no white boys and sell them for slaves, I said. She give me one of her looks, but don't say nothing. For another, white people don't have to be scared, like my daddy always was, always looking over his shoulder. I guess you's right. But no white man ever done me no good, she said. I told her about Mr. Spencer and how he helped me out. He was white, I said. What about him? I suppose everybody got a little good in him, she said. Mr. Spencer got a lot of good in him, and so does Mr. Burton. You just don't want to see it, I say. And she shoots me a look that shuts me up. Truth is, I don't know what to think of Mr. Burton no more. After he runs off and leaves me alone with Suki, I got no use for him. But then he comes back, and I see how good he takes care of Suki and Kitty. I never would have pegged Mr. Burton to be a daddy, but with Kitty, it's like she's his own. He claims when we make it out of here, he's gonna raise her free. I figure it'll fall on me to raise Kitty up, because Robert don't know nothing about babies. And if Mr. Burton is still gonna be white, Kitty will be down in the kitchen with Robert and me. I wonder what kind of kitchen that'll be. Mr. Burton said we can't live in Philadelphia no more, so where we end up at, I don't know. I sure hope Mr. Burton means to stand by me and keeps me with him like he said he would. But you never know with a man who runs like that. Even though I keep thinking that Philadelphia is where my mama and daddy live, in some ways I'm glad that we're leaving. That way, slave catchers come looking for me, I'm gone. Wonder how long they keep looking for their slaves that run. Daddy said they never stop.
Chapter 44. 1830. James. We were drawn through the water for what seemed an eternity. I tried not to panic at being trapped in the small enclosure, but as the long hours passed, I grew increasingly distressed. My one relief was Pan beside me, who was silent but as brave as any man. It was difficult to gauge time. We must have traveled for hours and had gone through at least 2 tolls before I sensed that our direction had changed and that we were traveling north. I was proved right when the man above, as though speaking to the woman, announced loudly, "We on the big canal now. Won't be long before we get to the landing." Soon, amid sounds of horns and chugging, our small barge lifted and sank in the water as larger boats went by. Where were we headed? Surely a small craft such as this would not travel up as far as Suffolk or Norfolk. It felt a lifetime had passed before the barge began to bump and thud in docking. Greetings were shouted, and through them I learned that I was on Joe's boat. He was well known and heartily greeted, as was his son, but his wife, Miss Lou, was noted with surprise. "See, you brought the missus," was heard more than once. "Joe, you get yourself a new little one?" a voice called out. "No," he called back. "Miss Lou been keeping the baby for her sister till she get her health back." "Hey, Joe, you selling that fine goat?" "Nope, afraid not. I gotta keep it for the baby. Child's nothing but trouble. All she can take is that darn old goat's milk." "Joe, you get yourself some mighty fine melons there?" "I can't sell them here. I'm taking them up to the hotel. I promised last time out I'd be back with them." "You mean to tell me you still going up there today? You never gonna make it." "No, it okay with you we bank up here for the night, leave first thing in the morning. What you fellas charge me for that?" "How about you give us some of those melons and we call it even?" Joe laughed, as did the others. "That sound good enough," he agreed. And so we anchored for the night. Joe and his family stayed on the raft while visitors came by. They brought food, and Pan and I suffered when we caught scent of roasted chicken. As they ate, the small group above us spoke like old friends, catching up on latest gossip. One man stayed behind after the others left. Joe brought him to the back of the barge, where they sat down together and their conversation was easily overheard. "Patroller's been through a couple times these past weeks. Ain't seen this kind of fuss in a long while. They got their eye out for a one-eyed black man who say they look white as them. He's with a nigger boy and a slave woman carrying a child. I heard there are a lot of money riding on them."
"Sound like those patrollers a rough bunch," said Joe.
"They's rough, but nothing like the one that comes through on his own. Seen him before, name's Rankin. Claims to know the man who runnin'. He's set to find him."
"He must be wanting that money real bad," said Joe.
"Suppose so. All I know is he sure do mean to find him. Say, you got your free papers on you?"
"You know I don't go up this water without 'em," Joe said.
"Just keep your eye out. Don't moor up if you see them patrollers."
"Times like this," Joe said, "I sure do wish I had me a gun." The other man gave a deep-throated laugh.
"You and me both, Joe. Imagine us two niggas with guns. Hoo-wee, can you see it now? We do ourselves some hunting."
His voice grew low.
"See here, I'm sliding a knife under this pile of wood, case you got need of it. Traded with an Injun for it just the other day. I'm not needing it right now, and there ain't no harm in it sitting here."
"I sure do thank you," said Joe. "I got me a small one, but one that size."
"This one do the job, is what it do."
"I spec so," said Joe.
And their conversation ended when the two parted. Trapped as we were, on hearing Rankin's name, all I wanted was escape. I used all I had in me to fight the instinct to call out to Joe for release. As the night deepened, everything above us grew silent and time lost meaning. Pan slept, his head turned away, and as I listened to his shallow breathing, the concern I felt toward him was akin to what I felt for Kitty. There had been a dramatic change in Pan since his abduction, and it angered me to think of how the past months had affected him. I wanted to join Pan in sleep, but I passed the night fighting a terrible thirst that grew with each lap of water against the raft. My need became so strong that I was tempted to lick at the damp floor, though I restrained myself, knowing the folly. Twice I heard Kitty cry, but each time I was relieved to hear shuffling and noises from the goat, and then she became quiet again. I must have slept, for I was startled awake when our barge began to move out. My head ached from the cramped position I was in, and when I turned my stiff neck, it was to see Pan's eyes staring into mine.
"Mr. Burton, I peed on myself," Pan whispered softly.
"Me too," I whispered back, and we exchanged a grimacing smile. As we traveled up the canal, my anxiety grew. Where were we going? Who would be helping us? Had arrangements been made for Kit? How could I transport the goat? Where was Rankin? When we docked again, I guessed it to be late afternoon. As everyone left the barge, it felt like we were being abandoned, yet we dared not speak. Later that evening, Pan clutched my arm as footsteps approached. Then came relief on hearing Joe's low voice, who came with his wife and another man. Within minutes, they had shifted the cargo, and the trapdoor was finally opened. They took Pan out first, but there was a whispered argument when he did not want to leave without me.
"Look, boy, you gotta stay quiet and listen. We trying to help you. Now come with me," the woman said, then whisked him away.
When Joe encouraged me to back out, my legs were too numb to move, so he and his accomplice grabbed hold of my feet and dragged me out. I clung to them as they half-carried me off the barge and up onto dry land, where they set me down. Where was I? I looked around as I stretched my limbs and saw our small craft tied in a secluded inlet. Up ahead, more sizable boats were anchored at a large dock lit by the welcoming lamps of what appeared to be a hotel. Again, the men helped me to my feet. My strength was returning, and we soon made our way into one of the large barns. We hurried past the horses, quietly munching hay in their stalls, to a small feed room at the back. There, bags of feed were piled high, but to the side was a small opening where the two men silently pushed me through. No sooner was I in than they began to seal up the entry.
"Where's the boy?" I whispered.
"We bring him to you later," I heard.
"How long will I be in here?" I asked, dreading another enclosure.
"I don't know, but there's some water and something in there to eat," Joe said. Before the last bag was put in place, I poked my head out.
"Wait, where are we?" I asked.
"We at the hotel that sit at the border between Carolina and Virginia," said Joe. "You got a ride coming."
"A ride?" I asked in disbelief. "What kind of ride?"
I remembered Kitty.
"Where's the baby?" I asked.
"I brings her and the boy to you when the time right, not before," Joe whispered, slinging the last bag into place and blocking further communication. Though the small space was dark, when I slumped to the floor, I felt the supplies that had been left for me. My hands shook as I tipped up the small bucket of water and drank from it. Then I fell to wolfing down all the bread and dried meat. I drained the bucket of water and then lay back. I woke with my stomach cramping, and though I fought for control, I heaved up my meal as I lost control of my bowels. When I recovered, I sat back to consider my miserable state. My clothes, already in shreds, were impossibly soiled. My hair had not been cut, nor had I been shaved in many weeks, and a stench rose from me that reminded me of the afternoon when the slave coffle passed by. I remembered well my disgust when their ripe scent lingered. Now I was left to contemplate the privileged position from which I had made a judgment. Too weary and sick to think further, I laid my head down again and fell asleep. I was unsure how long I slept, but I awoke suddenly, startled by Joe's voice. He was hurriedly dismantling my protective barrier, and when the bags were lifted away, he urged me out. It was dark in the room, but as my eyes adjusted, I saw Joe first, and then another dark face came into view. I stumbled back in disbelief. Nothing could have prepared me for the sight of Robert.
Chapter 45. 1830. James. What Robert's initial feelings were at seeing me in my terrible state, he did not say, but after a few slow moments, he greeted me with a nod.
"Good evening, Mr. Burton."
"Robert," was all I managed to say before he turned to Joe.
We will need fresh water and plenty of it, Robert said. I had already peeled away my soiled clothing when Joe returned with a bucket of water, and as I washed myself down, Robert told me about a waiting carriage. Then, to my amazement, he produced some of the clothes that I had left back at the Spencers.
How did you get these?
I asked as I gratefully slipped into clean drawers, a fresh white shirt, and my worn but clean riding clothes.
I will explain all of that later, he said, handing over my riding boots. I have Pan with me, I said, struggling to pull the tall boots over my torn and swollen feet.
I know. They just put him in the carriage, Robert said, and I could have wept in relief.
Do you have the baby as well? I asked.
He straightened to look at me.
The baby? He asked.
Yes. I turned to Joe. Where's Kitty? I asked.
I go for her now, he said.
A baby? Robert asked again.
Yes, I said. She's only a few weeks old. What size is the carriage?
It's yours, the one I brought from Philadelphia.
Good. Then we'll have room for the goat.
The goat? Robert said.
I need it for the milk, I said. Robert looked at me in dismay.
The carriage is already filled to capacity. There are two women along for the journey.
In the carriage?
We have no choice in the matter. They've come to assist us, he said.
Well, we need to make room for the goat, I said. He stared at me.
A goat, he repeated.
Why in all of this was he fixated on the goat, I wondered.
The goat has to come, I insisted.
As you wish, he said.
I buttoned my waistcoat, and Robert handed over a pair of spectacles instead of the expected eye patch.
These are meant to change your look, he explained.
Are we ready to leave? I asked, fitting them to my face.
The carriage is ready, sir, but first we must drive over and pick up the women where they are staying at the hotel. Then we will leave.
You take the carriage up to the hotel and gather the women. Then come back here for me.
Leave you here.
Are you quite certain? Robert asked.
Yes, I answered.
Go ahead. I'll be waiting for you with the baby.
Robert left, but twice turned back to see if I had changed my mind.
Go on, I encouraged him.
Kitty was asleep when Joe arrived with her. When I took her in my arms, I was so relieved to see her that I kissed her satin face. When I looked up, Joe had left. I paced with Kitty as I waited for his return, wondering why it was taking him so long. I remembered the offers of money that Joe had for the goat. Was it possible that he did not mean to return? Kitty could not survive without the milk. Carefully, I cradled the sleeping baby between two bags of grain, then hurriedly slipped out of the feed room into the barn. From there, I ran out. It was farther to the water than I remembered, but when I got to the barge, I found Joe struggling with the frightened goat.
I tried to tie up her mouth, he grunted.
Together, we quickly finished the job.
Here, take this, Joe said, and reached under the pile of wood. Careful with it.
He handed me a long sheathed knife.
It got some cut to it.
I'll get it back to you, I said gratefully while Joe scooped up the goat and left at a trot.
Look, there is the carriage,
I said in a loud whisper, pointing to where it stood in the shadow of the barn.
You take the goat to the carriage. I'll get Kitty, I said, and sprinted ahead.
I might have rushed in, but there was light from a lantern back in the feed room, and I doubted Robert would have brought it. I heard a threatening voice and dropped down to edge my way forward.
I'm asking you one more time, where's James Pike at?
A cold chill covered my body. I could not mistake Rankin's voice.
I do not know a James Pike, said Robert.
Where was Kitty? I moved closer but stopped when a floorboard creaked.
You don't know him? Somebody at Southwood said you was down there looking for him.
I've come to the Carolinas to take a young lady back to Philadelphia to attend her school, Robert said, his voice high and afraid.
I inched forward again.
No white girl's gonna travel with no nigra.
She has her maid in attendance, sir.
Sir? Attendance? Listen to this nigra talk like he think he's something.
Kitty gave a sudden cry.
What's that you got back behind you? Rankin asked in surprise. Give it here.
No, Robert argued.
I crept forward, unsheathing the knife.